Today on the Nerd Outcast podcast, we discuss Ray Bradbury. Hello and welcome back. I'm your host, Chris Passion. Is Ray short for Raymond? Do we know? Does anybody know?
It's no. Just Ray.
It's just Ray. It's just Ray. Okay, great. Now that that's done, thank you for listening.
The burning questions.
We are going to discuss the prolific author, Ray Bradbury. I'm really excited about this. A lot of people have actually suggested this topic, and I feel it's one of the foundations of nerddom, so it's kind of strange if we never talked about it. Kind of like Star Trek. So here we go. Let's jump right in. I'm your host, Chris, and I have brought my group of experts and people who think they know a lot about Ray Bradbury, probably do. My first expert today is...
Pete Novice.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm pretty good.
And we've had you on quite a few times.
Yeah. I think this is the first... No, this is not the first
it's
book.
It's not. Nope.
No.
We discussed Ender's...
Ender's Game.
We did it. Did you ever see the movie?
I did, and it was so... bad.
For those of you who listen to the Ender's Game podcast, we had not seen the movie at that time, so you think it was really bad.
It was like somebody who had read the book told somebody else a rough outline of the plot, and that person then made a movie strictly of the quotes that first person had given them.
That sounds awful.
It was rushed. You didn't care about anybody. It was bad and sad and...
Okay. Let's not start you down the dark path.
We'll have a whole other podcast about that at some point.
We will. So, Pete, for people who maybe are hearing your lovely voice for the very first time, what type of nerd are you? What do you enjoy?
I'm pretty all-encompassing. I do lots of reading, lots of sci-fi, fantasy, classic literature, stuff like that. Little bits of the sort of comic book graphic world... graphic novel world, whatever. Movies, gaming, both tabletop, online, and board.
Nice.
And yeah, just
Is there
a Renaissance nerd?
Okay. Is Ray Bradbury one of your favorite authors?
Yes.
Is he your favorite author? And if not, who is?
Maybe.
Okay.
At least in terms of whose work is just consistently pleasurable to read. In the moment of reading it.
Hmm. Is there somebody else? I mean, you say maybe, so I'm just curious who else is...
Well, I think there are other authors who will write a better story in terms of, you get, The Lord of the Rings or Ender's Game, for arbitrary example. and those books are great because of their story. Mm-hmm. Ray Bradbury's books are great because you can open a page and it is... poetry, but
wow.
it's just I can't explain it.
We're gonna make sweet love to Ray Bradbury tonight. My second expert today is
Kitten McCreary.
Welcome back, Kitten.
Hi.
I believe you were also on the Ender's Game podcast.
I was.
Did you see the movie?
I did.
Okay, we're not gonna talk about it just from that reaction.
And
I believe you were on our Star Trek podcast not too long after that.
Yes.
Wrath of Khan, original series.
We talked about original series, we talked about Wrath of Khan.
Nice.
We segued weirdly into all the wonderful things about bald women and the way the Star Trek universe made them wonderful.
True. You have a crush on Lieutenant Ilia.
Oh, yeah, and the Borg Queen.
Yep.
And good
and that's
stuff.
All a Moby Dick story, so
yes.
There we go.
Yes.
Perfect. So for people who may be listening to you for the first time, what type of nerd are you?
I'm a poly nerd. I'm a nerd about so many things. Books, movies, and even within that, multiple genres of science fiction and fantasy and horror. Also, not as much of a nerd for role-playing games as I used to be. I started playing role-playing games when I was really young and then just sort of stopped.
You stopped.
I did. I had a couple of really, really good gaming groups, and I felt like nobody else would ever measure up. And then, you know, TSR tried to trademark the word Nazi, and things just got weird. Also a nerd for, you know, board games, kind of getting into some online gaming. And I'm also, like, I'm a nerd for theater and horror and billion and one other things you can be a nerd for. I've frequently made a living being a nerd.
What's the most unusual thing that you're a nerd for? Like, something that other nerds are not a nerd for? Aside from bald women.
Antiquated medical equipment.
Fascinating. We'll do a podcast on that.
And there's a ton of it out there. There's a lot of people, and you're seeing it more and more now, I think, with the, you know, up and coming, like with the steampunk movement and all of that. You get people who are really into, like, the old, like, 16 to 1800s medical devices. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's a lot there because they look terrifying and they did horrible things to the body, and that's really flipping cool.
All right, let's bring it back. All right, now I know why that's a, no, I get that.
Yeah.
Ray Bradbury,
yes,
is he your favorite author?
I think he is one of my favorites. For me, books, much like music or movies, depend on my mood. But I don't think there's ever a time when it's like, no, I absolutely am not in the mood to read any Ray Bradbury. Like, that just doesn't happen, because his work is always appealing.
Okay.
But there will be times that I discover new authors, or times that I discover new works from authors I already knew, or times when an author's words just resonate with me more.
Okay.
And, you know, so in that particular moment, they will be my favorite author.
Who is your favorite author right now?
In this very specific moment, it's Warren Ellis.
Okay. I don't know who that is, but all right.
Transmetropolitan, The Authority. He's also the one who's doing the rewrites of the new Moon Knight comic book series. Okay. He wrote Red, which was made into a movie with Bruce Willis and multiple others. One of his other somewhat recent novel releases was The Gun Machine, which was brilliant.
Okay. Cool.
But this isn't about him. This is about Ray Bradbury.
So Ray Bradbury.
Now I want to see Bruce Willis do a movie just by himself. No other actors.
Yeah, there were other people in the movie, but...
All right.
John Malkovich.
All right. We'll talk about Bruce Willis later. My next expert is...
Tiffany Keene.
Welcome back, Tiffany.
Thank you. I was just on very recently.
You were, but you were on one of my Spotlight episodes. Now you get to be on the full... episode.
I get all the experiences.
You do. And I'm so glad that you made it out tonight, because during the Spotlight episode, you talked a lot about Ray Bradbury.
I did.
I'm really curious to see who's going to, like, know the most and love that man the most tonight.
Oh, it's a contest? I didn't know it was a contest.
We can make it.
Throw that gauntlet down.
Tiffany, what type of nerd are you?
I am definitely probably the biggest theater nerd. Mm. That's probably where I'm going to put most of my stake in, but I am an also overall nerd. I'm a nerd for good storytelling. I'm going to just say that.
Okay. I don't think anyone is a nerd for bad storytelling. I don't think I've ever...
Some people love bad stories.
I guess. I mean, they love bad... Okay, I don't know. whatever. Now, is Ray Bradbury your favorite author?
I'm going to have to say he is my favorite author, only because he's influenced my artistic work the most.
Okay.
And I have, you know, had so many adventures with his work, that I'll have to say that he's probably my favorite, only because I feel like I have semi of a personal stake.
Is there somebody who is a close second?
I have an appreciation for all of the major science fiction authors. I just... don't have that relationship like I do with Ray Bradbury.
Okay, cool. We'll hold on to that. We'll come back to that.
Absolutely.
My final expert, who is also a newcomer tonight, is...
Oh, I'm Jared Latour. Hi.
Hi, Jared. Welcome. You said you've done podcasting before. Why were you caught off guard by that?
That doesn't mean I pay attention all the time.
Oh, okay. Well, focus up, Jared.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'm here.
Welcome to the podcast.
I'm very excited
to have you. I am just meeting Jared for the first time, so I hope you're not like a serial killer or anything.
Surprise!
Yay! Jared, so what type of nerd are you? This is for those listening and for all of us here in the room with you.
Sure. I try not to discriminate. I mean, I've dabbled all over the place. That sounded like something a serial killer would say. For me, definitely literature, okay. Cinema. I don't know that I'd call myself a theater geek, although I do a lot of theater.
A gamer?
Not so much as I used to. When I was in high school, I admit I played Dungeons & Dragons for a while. All
right.
I played EverQuest, World of Warcraft,
ooh,
all of those.
EverQuest. I could never... Wow.
Yeah, that's going way back, right?
Yeah. That's with, like, modems.
My problem... Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was absolutely modem dial-up. That was my gateway into MMORPGs.
Okay.
Which I never really used those the right way.
What does that mean?
Well, here's the thing. You're supposed to, like, play with other people and make, like, a social event out of it.
Uh-huh.
And I would just want to go and kill monsters by myself. Like, the other players, I couldn't really...
No, wait a second.
That's I play.
Yeah, both of you do that.
That's okay. Very much like... I know my six friends.
Yeah.
Those are the people I'll actually play with.
Okay. Yeah.
I won't even play with them.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
You two are like introverts on an MMO, which is really weird. But
right.
It works.
Well, me too. I was the same way. And that's why I'm like, this is like a video game, but without like a proper story behind it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think
this is just me standing at a lake fishing for experience points and trying to get the polar bear hat.
All right. Let's bring it back to literature.
Okay, sure.
Is Ray Bradbury one of your favorite authors?
Definitely in the pantheon. He'll always have a special place in my heart, because I think the first thing I read by him was The Martian Chronicles. And I read that when I was in middle school. And it was at that sort of, you know, formative age. And he sort of introduced me to all of these new ideas, sort of opened my mind that a story is so much more than just a plot.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the gateway authors for sort of expanding my literary experience in that way.
Okay.
So cool. I'll always be indebted to him for that, and I'll always love him for it.
Is he your number one?
Like I said, I don't know that I have a number one.
Is there a contemporary or someone else who is very
Definitely. Like, one of his influences, too, is also one of mine, is H.G. Wells.
Oh.
And for a long time, I went around saying he was my favorite author, and he might be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. That is actually a really good segue.
Okay.
Because I want to start talking about this guy. I am going to double as host in Outcast tonight. I'm familiar with a little bit of Ray Bradbury. I read him a long time ago, but I'm definitely not nearly as up-to-date as you four people are. Also, my other Outcast couldn't make it, so...
Slacker!
Slacker. I've been busy. Whatever. I'm going to just kind of open this up, and anyone can take this and run with it. So, let's talk about the man himself first. Where did Ray Bradbury come from?
Illinois.
Waukegan, Illinois. Did I get a point?
You get a point.
Yes!
You are in the lead, sir.
All right.
So, he came from Waukegan. That's great.
Let's just slide over that.
Oh, okay. Well, did he always want to go into writing? Yeah. Can anyone speak to this? Did he study that? Was he something else?
He started writing when he was like 11 or 12 years old.
Oh.
Just knew that that's what he was going to do with his life. And then when he was, I think, 14, his family moved from Waukegan, which was basically like small Midwestern town, to Hollywood, because his dad got a job there. So he would like go hang out in front of movie theaters and run into movie stars and get their autographs, and like got sucked into that whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he also spent a lot of time in his youth like bouncing back and forth between Illinois and a small town in Arizona. And I think both of those things, both of those environments very much dictate the aesthetic of a lot of his stories.
Real quick, how what time frame are we talking about here when he was living in Hollywood and whatnot?
I was about to say this was during the Great Depression.
Okay.
And his family went to Los Angeles for work because they needed money.
Okay.
By the time they got there, they only had $40, which was worth more money back then.
Of course.
It was quite a bit, but still not enough to feed your family for too long. Ray Bradbury, his family was so poor that he was writing on butcher paper. And I want to contextualize that, too. It wasn't like fresh butcher paper. This was used butcher paper. He was writing on paper that was soaked in the juices of dead animals. So strong was his desire to write. Because he couldn't afford paper, so...
I feel that like either curses you or blesses your work in some really weird way.
Yeah,
from what I know from magic.
I mean, he is renowned for his sense of the macabre. So
okay.
There you go.
Yeah. But yeah, this is he was born in like 1920, I want to say.
Okay. Do you mentioned that his dad got a job in Hollywood. What was his family doing?
It was labor. It wasn't like a movie job.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing glamorous. His parents were not super well educated or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Neither was Ray Bradbury, mm-hmm. actually. He had a high school education and that was it.
Oh.
He was self-taught as a writer the rest of the way.
Can any of you speak to what maybe influenced him?
Well, he always said that he was a big proponent of being self-educated and that he was raised by the library and that he would go to the library, you know, 3 times a week and be there for 6 hours a day and all he would do is just read and read and read.
That makes me angry. Because I didn't know what I wanted to do at 11.
Yeah.
Come on, Ray Bradbury, stop it.
Well, I mean, he started off being a magician.
What?
Yeah. He started off like learning magic and sleight of hand and three card Monty and stuff like that. And he was doing that around the same time, like he was, you know, realizing that words are everything and he wanted to start writing. And he had a couple of teachers when he was in middle school who, you know, recognized his talent and very much encouraged him. But yeah, and you can, again, you see a lot of the stuff of like his interest in magic and in those skills in the foundations of a lot of his stories. And he also commented at one point, like his mother, when he was very young, his mother took him to see Phantom of the Opera. And you know, and he said that, you know, it made an indelible impression on him. And so having all of these different weird, broken, dark pieces as he grew up, you know, formed his world.
So, I guess my next question would be, did he immediately, come out with a hit title, or did he work in another field for a while, or...?
No, his first paying writing job was writing a joke for... Goodness,
it was some magazine.
It was for some variety show.
Yeah,
Was his first paying acting job. He wrote a few things as just submissions as serial things for magazines that he never got paid for,
mm-hmm.
And then his first novel. It was noted that he wrote on rented time at a typewriter at a public library.
Hmm.
So, you know, he was already, paying to do this, and...
Yeah. He worked his way up from writing for fan magazines that didn't pay him, then he got published in real magazines that did pay him, and then through that, he just sort of amassed this, this array of short stories.
Hmm.
And, so he's like, I should try to get these published as a book. People do that, right? So, him and he's just gotten married by this point. And he's kind of tight on funds. So he's like, okay, I'm going to make a gamble. I'm going to roll out to New York, meet some publishers, see if I can get a book published. They all tell him the same thing. Your stories are nice. Do you have a novel? And he didn't have a novel.
Speaking to his stories, mm-hmm. at that point in history, were his stories considered groundbreaking or...
Not until his first book came out. People liked his stories. But it was when Martian Chronicles finally came out. Yeah, that was what got him all the critical praise and praise from other famous authors as well.
Okay, and that was his first. That was his first big splash.
That was his first published book because he finally met a publisher who said, "Okay, you don't have a novel. Do you have a bunch of stories with a common theme?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe tie those together with a little bit of narrative tissue. We'll print that."
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Dark Carnival was his first published book.
Right, but that was his first published book, but not first published novel, right?
Martian Chronicles technically is not a novel.
What's that mean? What's going on? I'm panicking.
Martian Chronicles is still... It was written to be a series of short stories that are somewhat interrelated, and they had little vignettes in between the stories to help tie them together, but it was still structured in such a way that he wanted each story to be able to stand alone.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah, it's clearly like things that were written separately and then assembled.
Hmm.
So it's not so much, it's not a novel in the sense of this is a story that, you know, lasts you 300 pages or whatever. But I think it was the first
thing he really got notoriety for.
Okay.
But Dark Carnival came out 3 years before.
And once that happened, I mean, was he set? Did he just suddenly become
I don't know if that truly happened until Fahrenheit. I think Fahrenheit is really what propelled him into the mainstream eye.
Yeah, that made him a megastar. Yeah.
I feel that's what everyone thinks of when they hear the name Ray Bradbury.
It's on his tombstone.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's all it says on his tombstone.
Don't burn my books.
Author. Yeah. please,
don't burn my books.
Because that would just be too ironic.
Anything else you guys want to say about him growing up? I kind of want to jump into some other topics, but yeah.
I think that the cool thing, at least I just want to highlight about Fahrenheit, just right before he got into stardom, is that it was actually published by Playboy magazine. That's how it started as a fireman. It was like actually a novella first, and it was Hugh Hefner who was like, "Let's put this in."
Yeah, it was. It started out as a
boy. Was he? Oh wait.
Yeah, that's true. It started out as a 25,000 word short story, and then they said, "We like that, but we want it to be twice as long so we can sell it as a novel."
I bet if anyone has that, it's worth so much money.
Like the original?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh my gosh.
Except the pages are all sticky. No.
Thank you.
They had to go there.
You have lost a point. So let's, before we jump into specific books, let's kind of take a quick step back. So what are some of the common themes and maybe styles or hallmarks of his writing? I find this is kind of a good place to jump off of.
A lot of his stuff is really surreal.
Okay.
It's not, he doesn't write so much science fiction as he writes sort of like horror, fantasy, you know, like he takes these ideas of like, oh, what if everyone in the family was a monster and then there was one normal person who felt like they were an outcast. But his stories are also a lot about, like...
That was from Ray Bradbury's The Munsters, right?
Yes, basically. but it's about, like, feeling like the outsider and how does society treat you when you don't fit in. It's about being someone who wants to hold on to the past and, like, society is rushing past you. It's about desperately trying to hold on to something that you have no way to hold on to.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think that... For me, one of his most prominent concerns as a writer is the trade-off between humanity and technology. Like, in all of his, well, most of his stories and all of his books, I feel like there's at least one chapter where somebody has too much technology and they sort of lose their soul and give it over.
Mm-hmm.
We have that in Martian Chronicles with what's the story I'm thinking of? The one with the robot family and then the robot towns. And the Marionettes Incorporated,
yes,
isn't that from Martian Chronicles? Yeah. We have that in Fahrenheit 451 with the basically sort of a holodeck that he has.
Yeah.
They have
the parlor walls.
Yeah.
And the Velt.
And the Velt, which
the Velt,
is actually
a
holodeck.
Yeah, it's holodeck. It's
yeah.
kind of a holodeck.
And I think you also, something else you see in a lot of his stories, which again, tying back to his childhood, he writes a lot about the family, and about preserving those family values, and especially about, you know, family values in small towns, which are often very different than a lot of the family values you find in bigger cities because the whole setting is just so much more intimate and involved and people knowing everybody else's business all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you see that theme recurring a lot. And sort of tied in with all of the stuff that he writes about, you know, soul versus technology or man's dependent on technology, he also writes a lot that's in support of exploring, but talks about the dangers of wanting to force too much change.
Yeah.
And sort of like the man versus his environment in a really horrible way.
Hmm.
Yeah, I agree completely. He wasn't by any means a technophobe or a Luddite or anything.
Right.
And I think the family thing is really important to what his writing style is. Because compared to other authors that we call science fiction authors, he hated that term, by the way.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, he considered himself a fantasy author because he thought that science fiction, when you wrote science fiction, it was about something that was actually somehow could be even remotely possible. Hmm. And his stories are strictly impossible most of the time. But the family
thunderstruck.
Thing... Yeah, yeah. The family thing, I think, is important to his writing style compared to other science fiction authors because he's so warm and inviting as a writer. And he doesn't go too deep into the hows of how things work. That's not important to him.
Right.
You compare him to other science fiction authors, hard science fiction authors, who go into the details of how everything works, and it all feels kind of cold and off-putting sometimes.
Right.
Like Arthur C. Clarke, you read Rendezvous with Rama.
Mm-hmm.
That whole book is them on this spaceship that's empty, and every time they find a new thing on the spaceship, they have to sit down for 15 pages and talk about what it might be, why it was built, and how it came there. And then it's frustrating at the end. This is a tangent now, I'm sorry. But it's frustrating at the end because then the spaceship is about to leave the solar system, and they're like, well, I guess time to go. Guess there are just some things that are unknowable. It's like, why were you dragging me along for 300 pages?
Yeah, whereas with Ray Bradbury, you have, like, you know, the perfect example in The Counterpoint is one of his short stories that, unfortunately, I forget the name of. It's all about, you know, the family is, you know, going to grandma's house for dinner, and, you know, nobody quite knows why or how it works, but grandma's kitchen always produces the most amazing foods and anything anybody ever wants. And it's all about scene after scene of people sitting down to have a meal until this aunt shows up and decides she's going to start tinkering with the kitchen. And then everything starts to become horrible. And the whole situation is resolved when they pack the aunt's bags, put them on the porch, and just send her on her way.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the technology of it and whatever else is never explained. It's all about the family dynamic.
Jared, you mentioned contemporaries. Is there anyone that he's often compared to?
I mean, he had such a long career that he has so many contemporaries.
True.
I mean, he's often compared to, like, writers who came much earlier than him, though. Like Edgar Allan Poe was a huge influence on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He borrows a lot from him. A little bit of a Lewis Carroll and his sense of whimsy. All the classical writers. A lot of poets, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like Keats and so forth.
He mentions a lot that Heinlein was actually a big influence in him, because he says that Heinlein was the first science fiction author to put science fiction and humanity together and highlight humanity, and that's what he wanted to bring to the genre.
And he was a lot of his favorite authors, too, were, he loves Shakespeare. Shakespeare shows up pretty frequently in a lot of his stories.
Really?
Stuff like that. He loved the movies. I feel like he drew as much, if not more, inspiration from cinema than he did from literature. Because it's the mood of cinema that creeps into his works, I feel like.
Him and Harryhausen were like best friends.
BFFs.
BFFs.
Yeah.
Forever.
He was also close friends with Gene Roddenberry.
What?
Who asked him to write Star Trek, and he was like, no, I can't write in somebody else's world.
But he still, like, he went and took a tour of the set, and everyone's like, oh yeah, he's gonna write for us. And, like, he went full well knowing that he was, like, never gonna write. And he's like, but I just wanted to go.
You guys do good work.
That's cool.
Yeah. Thanks.
William Shatner's like, who the fuck is that guy? All right. Well, I have apparently chosen the four best nerds to talk on this topic. So I kind of want to direct it a little bit here. So I'm going to, Pete, I want to start with you.
Sure thing.
So personal experiences. Like, how were you introduced to Ray Bradbury? And what works do you think really influenced you, if any?
I think his first thing that I really ran across was... I went to a very academic private high school.
No.
But I was, like, nerd among nerds.
No.
I was the guy who was always walking around with a 1,000-page book under his arm. Stuff like that. Like, I read for fun. And
why'd you use that in quotes?
because that's the part that other people couldn't comprehend.
Okay.
Like, they would be like, oh, what class is that for? I'm like, no, I'm just reading this. Because it's good. And then I ran across Fahrenheit 451, which of course is a book about the love of books and the fact that, like, everyone around you is throwing away this beautiful heritage. So it's I mean, nowadays the teenage outcast is reading, like, The Hunger Games, and it's like, I'm special. But I was like, yeah, I read, so I'm special.
You know, we're reading on iPads now, so in a way, we kind of are throwing away the books.
And you know what? Ray Bradbury hated ebooks.
Did he? I'm not surprised.
He wouldn't let publishers put his stuff on ebooks most part.
Because
he was like, this is the violation of everything that I stand for. Yeah.
You remember a few years back when there was that big scandal where, like, Barnes & Noble deleted 1984 from a lot of people's ebooks? Because it was... You guys remember
no.
Yes.
And the intense irony of that? That was exactly what Ray Bradbury was afraid of happening, and it happened. He was kind of a prophet sometimes.
But yeah, so Fahrenheit 451. The other big one for me, well, his short stories are all amazing, but the other, the kind of landmark for me is Something Wicked This Way Comes, which I mean, maybe women love it too, but I think it's a great story about like boyhood and like that time when you're in junior high and you sort of stop playing and have to start making decisions about what your life is going to be. And the different forces pulling you in those opposite directions.
Anything else you want to say about
There's so many things. There's so many things. But
I see you have notes. You all have notes.
Something
for you, Jared. Yeah, sorry.
The big thing that I think I really love about Ray Bradbury, as opposed to other writers, especially other science fiction writers, is his male protagonists have a poetic heart. You can have a spaceship captain who will talk for pages about the beauty of the stars. You can have men who will be broken by something and confess their feelings in public and fall apart at it and not be condemned in the context of the story for it. Like, those characters become loved or stoned to death. Because
did he write that one too?
Well, no, but I mean, it's also about like, if you expose yourself too much, what will people do to you?
Hold on to whatever. Absolutely. Whatever you've got going on over there.
I'm just going to cry a little bit. And then
that's back. That's fine. Kitten, so same questions to you. Personal experiences. How were you introduced to his work, and what influences did it have on you?
My introduction, my very first memory of Ray Bradbury work was when I was kindergarten-ish age, possibly a little bit before. And my grandmother was reading me The Halloween Tree as bedtime stories, which is, you know, this collection of integrated short stories, much like Martian Chronicles, of these kids who are going out trick-or-treating, and one of their friends gets sucked through this vortex, and the kids have to go on these adventures through these different things to try to save their friend. And all of these adventures are actually things that are sort of teaching the history of Halloween. And it's brilliant and beautiful and horrifying, and nobody should read that to a five-year-old. No, I loved it. It was wonderful. And from there, the next thing that I read, like, independently, you know, of family stuff, being like, here, we're going to read you these things, because my family did a lot of, like, we're going to sit down at night and just read books, and there was frequently Ray Bradbury stories in that. But yeah, the next thing that I read, like, just on my own was Something Wicked This Way Comes. And, you know, and that I loved it. And, you know, I guess, yeah, they are sort of like dark, macabre stories. And I love that, I guess, you know, and that sort of shaped me into being rather a dark and macabre adult. But they're still beautiful stories with just this rich sense of family and foundation and this, you know, investment in the places that you live. And I don't necessarily mean that as like, oh, this is the geographical area, but the places that you live in, the whole, like, these are the things that I need to work as being constantly familiar to me. These are the things that work as being what is safe to me. And he builds those in such beautiful ways and in such places you absolutely wouldn't expect it. Even with Something Wicked, where, you know, your bad guys are the people at the carnival, you still have in that story these beautiful, very solid relationships with the people at the carnival. Like, you understand who they are and why they're doing these things. And you recognize that even though the stuff they do in going out, like, you know, sort of like making people young again and turning these people into monsters and freaks, they're still doing it out of a sense of love. You know, because they're going to be like, these are your dreams. We're going to give them to you. And Ray Bradbury sort of has that whole, you know, be careful what you wish for theme in a lot of what he writes. But, you know, even though these are the bad guys in the story, you can't look at them and think of them as bad guys. Okay, I like villains.
I mean, they're some of the coolest villains.
They are.
His name is Mr. Dark.
Hold on to characters. We'll talk about characters.
Okay.
Real quick, something I wanted to ask that we didn't really touch on. Is there a specific age group that he writes for, or
nope?
Okay.
Well, there were a couple of occasions where he wrote for young adults. Like, mm-hmm. Halloween Tree was intended for young adults.
Right.
And, like, R is for Rocket and S is for Space. I think those are geared towards younger. But for the most part, he's for all ages.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, Tiffany, over to you. Personal experiences. How were you introduced to his work? What influence did it have on you?
The first book that story that I've ever read of his was All Summer in a Day. Which was a short story of his.
Yeah.
That was my first introduction to him, and it's about this class that is on Venus, and it rains. What?
No. I haven't read this, so it's a class. It's on Venus. Okay.
Venus has been colonized.
Okay.
Yes, Venus has been colonized, and it rains. It's a world of constant rainstorms, and this one child from Earth remembers what it's like to see the sun.
Hmm.
And she's trying to explain to her classmates what the sun's like, and she's just mocked and teased. And
what do you mean it looks like a lemon? How can that be good?
Yes, and then, she's trying to explain to her classmates what the sun is like, because the sun will come out in Venus, but only for, like, a period of an hour. And it's, like, an hour after 8 years or something
Yeah, once every 7 years, I think.
Like 7 years?
Yeah.
And, you know, when the sun is finally going to come out, she gets locked in a closet. And she's not able to see the sun. And it's only after the children experience what the sun is like that they realize, you know, what she was trying to express to them. And I think that actually really embraces all of the themes in all of his works. Like, there's that one outsider, as we were kind of brushing on before, that, you know, can see the light or see something, you know, positive and magical, and no one else can see it. So that was my first relationship with him. And then I, like, just was a Ray Bradbury fanatic, and I just, you know, tried to read everything that he has ever done. And he's influenced me, like, he was probably one of the reasons why I wanted to be a storyteller. Like, I just loved how, you know, his themes and his stories, like, impacted me and, like, made me want to be better and made me want the knowledge. I feel like he made me want to seek things in life. And I think that when he died, was probably the biggest impact on me as an artist, because I just graduated from college and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And it was, you know, I'm big in theater, and it was either start my own theater company or, you know, be an assistant director. And when he died, I was like, you know, I only have one life to live. And he was a big proponent of going for your dreams and, you know, jump off the cliff and build your wings on the way down is one of his, you know, best quotes.
That's
so
terrible advice. It's the worst advice I've ever heard.
Well, you better build those wings.
What wing building resources are you going to find in midair?
None.
Well,
I'll tell you.
Ask Ray Bradbury.
That's the secret.
You just grab bird after bird on your way down. Snap their brittle little bones and glue them to yourself.
Tiffany, go on. Ignore Jared. You lost a point.
Oh.
Oh, sadness.
Like Margo, I lose a point for being right.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah, it was his work that really inspired me to be a storyteller and, you know, made me the artist that I am today. And now Other World Theater Company, you know, I owe a lot to its success to, you know, his inspiration, so.
Okay. So, Jared.
Yes, sir.
Mister, you can't build wings as you fall.
Yes.
There might be logic to that, I don't know.
Okay.
So, same questions to you. How were you introduced to his work, and how did it influence you?
Well, for me, like, if I'm a geek or a nerd at all, I'd say that it all started with literature, so that's always been my path through nerdery or whatever you want to call it. Like, when I was a kid, I had this set that was basically like classics for kids. I don't remember the name of the actual series, but there was like Black Beauty and Great Expectations, and they would all be sort of abridged, and they'd add a bunch of illustrations to it. But the ones that I gravitated towards were always the H.G. Wells and the Jules Verne and the fantasy stories like that. And so I carried that with me all through my reading life until I got to, I think, middle school. And I saw this book called The Martian Chronicles. And I'm like, that's bound to be awesome. Martians? A chronicle about them? What's not to like?
And so, it was.
Yeah, so I peek into it and I'm like, this is not what I was expecting, but I like it. And I'm thinking, how are they all breathing on Mars? Even I'm a kid and even I know that's not possible. But then I realized that it was more important to look past that, that it was written in a language of metaphor. And suddenly I understood subtext. And that was like a breaking point for me. All Summer in a Day was another one I read in early age. And that one, it broke my heart. And that story's going to stay with me for my whole life. And then, too, Something Wicked This Way Comes. After I discovered subtext, I started looking too deeply for it. So I was reading Something Wicked This Way Comes, and I'm like, I know this is allegory, but I can't figure out for what. Now, of course, as we all know, it's a coming-of-age story. And I couldn't find that because I hadn't come of age yet. So I didn't know quite what to look for. I was looking too hard rather than just sharing in the experience. So reading Ray Bradbury, I can honestly say, has made me a better reader, a smarter reader.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So that's why I love him so much.
Whoever wants to take this and run for it, I'm going to just throw the ball up in the air. Your personal top three novels of his. If you had to choose three to be stuck on an island with...
Fahrenheit?
I think we can all say Fahrenheit, right?
I feel like Fahrenheit, Something Wicked This Way Comes are the two easy ones.
Okay.
There may be disagreement on the third one.
I don't think I'd take Fahrenheit.
Really?
Really. I mean, it's an amazing book, and I loved it, but it's not necessarily one of his stories that I feel the need to... go back to. I think in the whole desert island situation, my three are going to be...
If this is a desert island, I definitely don't want Fahrenheit 451. It would just make me miss all the books.
See? It's just going to make it worse.
I mean,
it's
a great book.
Yeah.
It's not a book that you need to read over and over and over and over. It's a book that everybody should read.
What's a book you need to read over and over?
Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Yeah, that's about every 2 years I could read that.
The Martian Chronicles.
Okay.
Because there's so much in The Martian Chronicles, and there's a lot to be learned from it. And then I think another one of mine that I would go back for a persistent reread, if it's not Dark Carnival, which is a collection of short stories, not a novel, but thinking strictly of novel, Graveyard for Lunatics.
See, I was going to go with that too.
Oh, that's one of his detective ones, right?
Yeah, it's part of the trilogy, and
it's sort of
the best in the trilogy.
Semi based on himself, like moving to LA as a writer who like gets hired to work on movies. Yeah. So it's a lot of that, like,
and his friendship with Ray Harryhausen and Hans Franz.
I don't know.
Yes,
Fritz Lang, probably.
Fritz Lang, yes.
Yeah.
It's a really awkward book, but it has some of his most beautiful writing in it. Hmm. It's not something that I would hand to somebody as their first Ray Bradbury book.
No.
Oh, I'll ask you that question.
I have to admit that the detective novels he wrote in his later career, I haven't read them. Not because I don't think they'll be great, but to me it's like going to Ray Bradbury for detective fiction is like going to a pizza place and then saying, oh, they have wraps here. I'm going to get a wrap instead of a pizza.
But I don't know. I mean, I think that's one of those things that's so wonderful about him is that he's not so mired in any specific genre. Mm-hmm. It's his use of language and imagery that makes all of his work breathtaking.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whether it's sci-fi or fantasy or horror, why not detective novels?
Right, yeah. No, that wrap is probably great. I can't bring myself to order it because I always go there for the pizza. I agree with you. He's more versatile as an author than most people give him credit for.
So do you find that like you only read his work that's more traditionally sci-fi, or do you also read his like horror and things like that?
If
you only want the pizza.
Oh, well, I mean, I have ordered a few other things off the menu.
Oh, okay!
Just not the wrap, because I'm not trying to eat healthy when I eat. Okay.
I've not had dinner yet, so this is a really horrible conversation.
Sorry. Yeah, another point to his versatility, and another great book that we haven't mentioned yet, Dandelion Wine.
Yes.
Yeah. It's an amazing story, probably his most personal, I feel. And
any reason it's his most personal?
Well, it's partly autobiographical. It all takes place, it's a series of stories that take place in this fictional place called Greentown, which is basically a thinly veiled Waukegan, Illinois. And it's all about his life growing up there in the late 20s. And when I read it, it makes me feel nostalgic for a life I never led. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, oh man, I sure miss growing up in the 30s and yeah, small town like, Illinois.
I wish
like,
I was one of the Waltons.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of wish I had been, because he makes it all feel so wonderful and alive and warm and passionate. And I want to compare it to another novel that tries to do that, like Farmer Boy, like by Laura Ingalls Wilder. That book is boring as shit, because it's all just, and this is what he ate for breakfast, and these are the chores that he did that day. There's very little conflict, and there is so much conflict in Dandelion Wine, and I think that's the tricky thing about writing a small town pastiche, is making conflict that's actually exciting.
Tiffany, Jared, I don't think I heard from you guys about your top three of his.
Well, I threw out Fahrenheit. Okay. I also really like I Sing the Body Electric. I'm really a big fan of his poetry and his use of word play and I'm also a big proponent of I guess it's kind of cheating, but I'm just going to throw it out there. His radio dramas that he wrote like are just breathtaking as well. On X-1, we performed some of those. Other World Has.
So let me get this straight. He's written short stories.
Yep. Yes.
Novels.
Yes.
Now we're adding radio dramas, poetry.
Yep.
Has he ever written for TV or films?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
He wrote episodes of both the original and the reboot of Twilight Zone.
Oh. Which I Sing the Body Electric was that.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was his Twilight Zone episode. Yeah.
He's written some short plays.
Yep. See,
which are gorgeous.
Yeah.
Do you know Kaleidoscope?
I do not know. I've heard of Kaleidoscope. He did Fahrenheit. He made a lot of his books into plays because he was a big proponent of theater. And
he wrote the film adaptation of Moby Dick.
Yeah.
And then he wrote a novel based on writing the
film adaptation of Moby Dick.
That's because Melville couldn't.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
just say it.
Whatever.
You know, forget it.
Any other... did he write the screenplay for Something Wicked's television?
I don't think he did.
Okay. Just curious.
He usually didn't adapt the TV or movie versions of his own novels.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other
He did very happily own the fact that all of his writing was very cinematic and commented at one point, like in an interview, he's like, you take anything I wrote, you can put it on the screen right now.
He really invested a lot in imagery and painting the picture for you.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely has short stories that take place completely inside somebody's head.
Yes. Yeah.
So
those can't really
translate.
It's
probably a slight
so
exaggeration.
Well. Yeah.
Jared, did we get your top three?
You're about to.
What are they?
I would be remiss if I didn't include Fahrenheit 451.
Okay.
That's his masterpiece,
mm-hmm.
and I can't not put that on the list of the top three, or I'll get angry comments from the internet.
Ray Bradbury did indeed write the screenplay for Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Well, I'll be damned.
Thank you, IMDb.
Stop being...
Somebody gets a point.
God.
It's IMDb.
That's
right. What two others?
Dandelion Wine, because I just raved about it, so the hell, I'll throw that in there. Whichever, I forget which collection All Summer and a Day comes from. Does anybody remember which one?
Was that Illustrated Man?
Yes. Yeah, Illustrated Man. Also a pretty cool, important work.
Yes. That's a lot of my very favorite of his short stories come from Illustrated Man.
The Veldt is in that one.
The Veldt is in that. Last Night on Earth, which I love.
Right, yeah.
Marionette Inc.
Yeah.
is in that, so yeah.
Here's a fun little question. I'm kind of curious what you're all going to say.
Mm-hmm.
What is his worst work? What just did not do it for you, or you just really feel it's just...
I'm not going to say it's bad because I still enjoyed it.
Okay.
But I think for me, his worst work is Let's All Kill Constance. Which
is the third of those.
Yeah, which is the third of the detective novels.
That was a vegetarian rap.
It's nothing but tofu and sprouts. Why would you do that? And that's one of those things that, like, the only reason I feel like it maybe falls a little short of his other works is because it is probably the only thing of his that I have ever read that you can't just pick up and read. You have to be familiar with the things in the first two novels in order for anything in the third one to work for you at all.
What about the second novel? I mean, I'm assuming you would have to be familiar with
the
first one.
The second novel actually stands very well on its own. I read them out of order. I read the second one, and then I went back and read the first and the third. So Let's All Kill Constance, which still has some beautiful language, and it has some great characters, but it is a very, like, weird, disconnected, yet spiraling plot nothing.
It's a story that, like, it presents itself as though it is a story that takes place in the real world, but then it devolves into this, like, metaphorical, like, can you reattain what you had in the past?
Yeah.
And it just, it's odd. But, I mean, I would also say that probably 20% of his short stories don't quite hit.
Work.
You know, you're reading through a collection, you're like, all right, well, that was only 6 pages. The next one will be good.
Yeah. I listened to, because we live in the 21st century, so I can look up Ray Bradbury on YouTube. Like, I wonder if he has any lectures. Oh, he does? Mm-hmm. Have hundreds of them? Mm-hmm. Thanks, YouTube. And at the beginning of the lecture, he said his advice to writers was, don't do a novel to start. You might spend a year on a novel, and it might still be crap. But if you wrote a short story a week, you'd have 52 short stories in the time it took you to write a novel. And I defy you to write 52 bad short stories. So just by law of averages, he wins out in the end.
He and Stephen King had very much the same approach to writing, in the idea that, yes, it's your passion, but it's also your job. Any other job, you have, like, a certain number of hours a day that you have to go and do that job.
Yeah.
So whether they were feeling in any way inspired or motivated at all, they sit down and write.
Huh.
And
yeah, he had hundreds, or, I mean, more likely thousands of short stories that he never published.
Wow.
Because they just
weren't
good.
Yeah.
Huh. Tiffany, Jared, do you, any things that jump out as his worst work?
Well, while we're talking about short stories, and this one might be controversial, but I'm going to say A Sound of Thunder, which is the one where there's this travel agency that you can book a ticket with them, and they'll send you back in time so you can hunt and kill a dinosaur. But they're like, we have to walk on this special path so that you don't disturb anything because of the butterfly effect, mm-hmm. chaos theory, that sort of thing. The dinosaur, they figure out, was going to die anyway. So it's okay to shoot him. So he walks in, and he's like, so you're the dinosaur hunting place? And I'm like, yeah. How about that presidential election yesterday? And I'm like, huh. I wonder if that's going to have anything to do with anything. He said, by the way, don't step off the path, whatever you do, or you'll change everything throughout the course of time. And I'm like, gee,
and
I wonder if he's going,
like,
to step off the path.
We don't know how much it would change.
Yeah. So he steps off the path, steps on a butterfly, and comes back, and the sign is spelled differently. And guess what? They picked the wrong president. So it's just contrived.
They elected the
Nazi
president.
And hokey.
Is that where that Simpsons episode comes from?
Yeah, they did a Simpsons
the
for, like, one of the Treehouse
Horrors.
They also made a movie, terrible movie, with Ben Kingsley, Sound of Thunder.
And it's so weird because that short story so often winds up in the list of, like, Ray Bradbury things that you must read.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
I mean, it's in Art for Rocket.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, why do people push that story? And the people who push it rarely seem to have a foundation of it being good storytelling or good literature.
It's a cool concept.
Yeah, it's always these are the dangers of what we could really do.
Yeah,
no.
But it's such science fiction cliche.
Yeah.
Tiffany, worst work.
Oh, I don't think I've read enough of his, of all of, I haven't read a lot of his short stories as much. So I've really read like his big hitters. So I couldn't really say that I've read some of his, but I will mention that A Sound of Thunder was a really great X-1 episode. The radio dramas.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you can, I can see that. Online.
It's got a lot of characters that are just interacting very strongly.
And, like, the dinosaur. It's pretty fun.
That could make it fun, yeah.
All right, if I am new to Ray Bradbury, which is probably really hard to do since he's required reading for most schools that I know of, but if I have never read any of his work, where should I start?
Martian Chronicles.
Worked for me.
I would, if you are a person who can read, like, I mean
if you're literate,
if you're not a person who can read, I don't think we should give them a Ray Bradbury.
Then start with the NPR radio series.
All right, slap you all. I mean, if you're a person who is generally comfortable with books, will read for pleasure and not just read for like, oh, I feel like I should, I would go with Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's a ridiculous amount of fun.
My other experts?
Oh, man. I guess I gotta be a Fahrenheit chick, I guess. I just, I feel like it's just so such a great commentary about the world that we live in and the juxtaposition between the world of, you know, having, you know, a fake fantasy life and trying to fill a void when you really all you have to do is, like, seek it within and try to find profoundness in nature and every day.
The difference between, like, real life and entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, trying to knock out the noise of you know, television and just, like, spectacle and just flashiness. And
Kitten, put your iPad away.
Not if you didn't read Fahrenheit 451 in, like, you know, middle school or high school, then you need to start making up for the fact that your school system failed you.
That's
you
probably
know,
a good
just
point.
So work on that.
Yeah, I agree. If somebody's going to read one Ray Bradbury book, it should be Fahrenheit 451. Yeah. If they're going to read something else, and I want them to get them interested in reading lots of Ray Bradbury books, I'd probably pick Martian Chronicles.
And even though, like, Something Wicked This Way Comes, I like a lot more than I like Martian Chronicles. I feel like Martian Chronicles is more representative of a larger percentage of his body of work as far as themes and styles.
You all have mentioned his short stories. Is there a collection of short stories that you feel like hit really high all the time?
A zillion of them.
I like Illustrated Man, I think.
That's probably his most famous collection.
I think so.
Okay.
Dark Carnival.
Dark Carnival is by far my favorite, but it's, again, I think he has other collections of short stories like Illustrated Man that are slightly more representative of a larger percentage of his body of work. Dark Carnival is more of his horror and more of his outcast within the family. Like when Pete was talking about, oh, it's the family of monsters and you're the one human. That's like one of the first stories in Dark Carnival. It's, you know, the homecoming where basically you have this boy and he's like, why am I so different from everybody? Why do I have this horrible disease? Why am I so broken? And all the family's going to be coming and he knows is, you know, they're all gathering for this big thing that they do every year to celebrate that he's going to be shunned and stuck in the corner and all of his siblings are constantly belittling him and abusing him. And then, you know, fairly quickly in the story, as more and more the family shows up, you realize that they're all vampires and shapeshifters, and he's human.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think for, like, advanced Bradbury readers who want to see him go a little bit off of his beaten path, I'd recommend a short story collection called The Cat's Pajamas. Because I don't think there's one story in that book where someone gets in a rocket. So that's kind of refreshing. Have you read that one?
Yeah, and I like his more recent stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's clearly the work of an older person. A lot of there are a lot of stories about like one that comes to mind is basically a guy who has just died, and he gets up out of his grave, and he can't understand why nobody's stopping to talk to him, and he's trying to go about his life, and he tries to go back and talk to his wife and go get some ice cream, and he runs into other dead people, and they're like, you have to understand, you can't hold on to this. They will stop being important to you.
That one was really beautiful too, because like his wife can, like there's a part where his wife who's still alive kind of fragments
of connection, and it's all this like, the past is gone, you can't get it back.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of his later stuff deals with that, and it also deals with that like, what was it like to be 14, and just like starting to learn who you are as a person.
Well, we are nearing the hour mark, so we've slowly got to start wrapping this up.
But
is there anything? We cannot go for a second hour. You all have brought books.
Yeah.
I don't know if are you wanting to read them on air? I don't know why you brought all these books.
Oh, well,
technically, copyright infringement.
This is not in the context of like quoting a work, in the context of a review.
Very true.
This is my Ray Bradbury challenge.
Okay.
Pick a book and give me a page number, and I will read you something awesome.
All right. What two books are you holding?
Book A or book B?
I'm gonna say left hand.
Right.
Well, you pointed at my right hand.
My left.
Give me a page number up to 290.
Page 196.
196. All right. What is awesome on page 196? Something gorgeous, I hope, because I will feel dumb otherwise. Somebody else talk for a second, and I'll find the best thing on this page.
One thing I want to mention that I don't think we mentioned yet about his writing style is his sense of humor.
Because
he had one of those, too. When he writes macabre, it's often... you know, dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
In The Cat's Pajamas, there's one story that I loved. It's called Hail to the Chief, and it's about these Washington senators who go to an Indian casino, run out of money, and start gambling away United States.
Oh my gosh.
And they end up gambling away the whole country to this Indian tribe.
And the president has
to come back and sort of bargain with them for the United States.
That's pretty awesome.
He likes inverting
what
do you call it? Societal structures.
Yeah.
Like, there's lots of stories where, you know, like The Other Foot, where African Americans now have the upper hand because the white people all want to immigrate to Mars where they all live now. And so, like, we're going to turn this around. When they get here, we are going to lynch the shit out.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
But then they show up and they're like,
we just lost our planet.
They're like, everything was destroyed, including all of the lynching trees and everything else, and all of these things that were markers of that time.
Yeah.
And so everybody on the planet is like, all right. And they let them all live there without having all of those, you know, the Tom Crow laws
in
place.
It's a new beginning.
Oh, it looks like you found something awesome.
Ready?
This is actually a badass page. So page 196, if something wicked this way comes. There's a couple characters having a conversation about the nature of humanity and good and evil. All right. If men had wanted to stay bad forever, they could have. Agreed? Agreed. Did we stay out in the fields with the beasts? No. In the water with the barracuda? No. Somewhere we let go of the hot gorilla's paw. Somewhere we turned in our carnivore's teeth and started chewing blades of grass. We've been working mulch as much as blood into our philosophy for quite a few lifetimes. Since then, we measure ourselves up the scale from apes, but not half so high as angels. It was a nice new idea, and we were afraid we'd lose it, so we put it on paper and built buildings like this one around it. And we've been going in and out of these buildings, chewing it over, that one new, sweet blade of grass, trying to figure out how it all started, when we made the move, when we decided to be different. I suppose one night, hundreds of thousands of years ago, in a cave by a night fire, when one of those shaggy men wakened to gaze over the banked coals at his woman, his children, and thought of their being cold, dead, gone forever. Then he must have wept, and he put out his hand in the night to the woman who must die someday and to the children who must follow her. And for a little bit the next morning, he treated them somewhat better, for he saw that they, like himself, had the seed of night in them.
I have to go. Damn.
It's so good.
It's fucking poetry.
Nice.
Nice.
Yes.
That could make a really fun drinking game, too.
Yeah.
Just every time, just take a shot and then do that.
Every page.
Sorry, I'm still emotionally reacting to that. And stop snapping me. anything we haven't talked about or any questions that you want to pose to each other or the group?
So Fahrenheit 451, like his greatest work for which he will be remembered throughout history. His protagonist is not that interesting. Like Guy Montag is this fumbling guy who's not that smart, who's just barely getting exposed to ideas. Like, I don't feel much personal connection to him.
Yeah.
Like, it's all the characters he runs into that I connect with.
Yeah, he's kind of a half a person, and the story is about him growing into becoming a full person. So when he starts out, he's not that bright or interesting. Yeah. And frankly, character I don't think is Bradbury's greatest strength to begin with.
Like Faber mm-hmm. and the Chief and Clarice
yeah.
are all like far more complete people with a viewpoint.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually really interesting because when Otherworld Theater put up Fahrenheit 451... We ran into that issue of, okay, how do we make Guy Montag this? He's definitely the everyday man, right? He's the filler for you. He's the protagonist where you can put yourself into this world and you're seeing the world through his eyes. How do we make him interesting? And one of the things that we kind of really try to bring to life is that he really is, in the beginning of the book, kind of the antagonist that doesn't know he's an antagonist. He enjoys burning books. He enjoys the revelry of, you know, burning these things, you know, like having that fatality about something and being destructive with fire. And then he learns throughout the progress of the book that he actually is taking away something very precious. And I think that he might not be a full-fledged character like in his other novels, but I think that there's something said I think that that's something interesting, at least to me when I read that book, is his journey of realizing what he's destroyed mm-hmm. and having that guilt of destroying.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, you just...
No,
You're making faces.
Again, for me, like, Fahrenheit 451 is just... It's a very good novel. I enjoyed it when I was in the 8th grade. And I read it. It's just not, despite how, like, revered it is, it's just not one of his most interesting works in content or character. So I'm like, people like Fahrenheit 451, hooray!
Yeah, I'm the same way about Empire Strikes Back.
It's... You're not. Don't
lie. I'm just trying to get comments now on my website. So we're over the hour mark. Any final thoughts? Anything? I mean, we can go around here. Pete, I'm gonna start with you. Haha.
Okay.
Any final thoughts? Something we didn't get to say or mention or.
I love the fact that though he was clearly like I'm a writer. He was not categorizable. You can't be like, oh, these are the kind of stories he writes, or like, oh, he did some stories, but mostly he did scripts. No, he did all of this stuff. He just did whatever came next, and he's this crazy advocate for like human connection and storytelling, and he hated the internet, and he hates video games. He's like, look, play a video game for 20 minutes, and then go do something real, which... You know, cuts at my heart when I read those quotes. I'm such a gaming nerd. But I'm like, come on, Ray, I gotta go. All right, I'll make art now. Okay, so.
Okay.
Yeah, is a fantastic in his own arts and in his advocacy for human connection.
Kitten?
He was a prolific writer in tons and tons of things. And one of the things that's always sort of amused me about him is that, you know, even though like so much of his writing is filled with so much compassion, and you know, and he has like a rather large, very like warm and wonderful family, there was a lot of things that he got amusingly cantankerous and curmudgeonly about, when he was doing a lecture at Dragon Con. Many years ago, somebody had talked to him about, you know, oh, you know, what about adapting your work for this or adapting your work for that, and especially looking at, like, video games and ebooks. And he, like, railed against it for several minutes, and people are like, God, Ray Bradbury's a dick.
Oh, I hope that's on YouTube. I kind of want to watch that.
It might
yeah.
be. But this was a thing like 15 years ago when he was there for Bet. But it was hilarious, you know, to have him be like just that honest about his work. And one of the other things that I love about him was that he discovered at one point that a comic book publisher had taken several of his works and turned them into comics. And he wrote to them, and he's like, this is wonderful. This is beautiful work. I really love the illustrations. I like, you know, how you've structured these things and how you've depicted these characters. By the way, do you think you could pay me some royalties? And they did.
Okay.
And but it was still like, he was still very nice about it. He was like, you know, he was still very complimentary of their work. Mm-hmm. Instead of, now I think you just have so many people diving in being like, lawsuits for taking our stuff.
Yeah.
But he loved the fact that they just took it and put it into another book form that he had not yet explored.
Somebody said something similar on the Neil Gaiman podcast about people taking his works and I don't know. Yeah. And he was like, that's great. Good. I mean, money would be nice, but yeah. Okay. You know, Tiffany, final thoughts.
I think that I kind of want to hark a little bit about what you were talking about how great of a guy he was. Like he always made himself available to new writers. He really wanted to, help them obtain and be the best writer they can be. Out in LA, he started a young science fiction writer group, and he would frequently go and just chat with them and read their short stories. And these were, you know, just college kids, or anyone could come and he would read your story. You could just bring it to him and he would read it and critique it and give you notes. And, you know, he was such a high hitter, but he never made himself that way. He always made himself available and down to earth. And I think that that's another reason why.
And he frequently encouraged them to write by hand with pen.
Yeah.
Because if you aren't going through those moments of getting cramps in your hands, then you don't really know what it's like to push through something and find the epiphany of the art.
That's well said.
Yeah.
I see you have a book open.
Yeah, I wanted to play this game too. You asked why we brought the books, and this, just because I was going to be on here, kind of got me in the mood to reread it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Dandelion Wine.
Okay.
And this is at the end of a chapter. This is, again, about the trade-off between technology and humanity. This guy gets it in his head that he's going to build a happiness machine. And as he comes home to his wife and says, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to build a happiness machine. And she says, something's wrong? And so in the process of building this machine to create happiness, he neglects his wife and children and sort of inadvertently destroys his marriage and ruins his own life pretty well as well. And it all ends in a fire, and he realizes the error of his ways, that you can't, you know, build happiness. It has to be earned organically.
Yeah.
And there's a line, a quotation, that's one of my favorite in the book. And he says, the first thing you learn in life is you're a fool. The last thing you learn in life is you're the same fool. I just really like that one. So,
well, on that.
So, as our outcast, Chris, let me ask, are you motivated now to go out and find more of his works, more Ray Bradbury's, and dive more into this?
This is frustrating.
Have we converted you?
We've got some books we can lend you.
Yeah.
Well, now here's the deal. You can. I'm a really slow reader. And somebody once said, if you lend a book, just expect to never get it back. So, if you lend me a book,
I think
you
can swing a $7.99 paperback.
Okay. I might find that.
It's really good. I'll leave it here on the table.
Nobody gave me a Neil Gaiman book, by the way, when we did that podcast.
You didn't invite me to your Neil Gaiman podcast, so can't help you there.
Well.
Yeah, yeah. But there were promises made.
There were promises made, hearts broken, you know. Well, with all of this said, I unfortunately have to bring the Neil Gaiman... with all of this said, I have to bring the Ray Bradbury discussion to a close. It's done. Wah, wah. Is there anything that anyone wants to plug? Other shows you're working on? Things that are up and coming in your life?
At the moment, Kitten and I are both performing in Bat Hamlet, which is awesome, at the Corn Conservatory. And then later this summer, we're going to be working on Jim and Dave's Blood Meets Jupiter with Project 891 Theater.
In the Chicago area, if
in
you're in the Chicago area.
Or fly to the Chicago area, because they'll be great.
Yes, fly to the Chicago area.
Batman Hamlet and a science fiction musical.
With puppets.
Nice. What is with you and puppets?
What is not?
All right, anyway.
Bat Hamlet through April 26th, 2014, depending on when you're listening to this.
True, if it's next year.
And then, yeah, I mean, it's a podcast. It'll be there forever. And then Project 891's for Jim and Dave's Blood Meets Jupiter is a June summer. Yeah, it's a June-July production, but I do not recall the exact dates. But we'll talk about that on a later podcast.
Don't you something?
Can't they listen to your voice on another podcast?
Well, we've recently done some stuff with Geek Spotting. As far as other stuff that I was working on, we haven't done anything in a good long time. Okay. So I'm gonna say no.
Cool. anything else you guys wish to plug?
I have something.
I'm working my way around. Tiffany, go ahead. Tiffany,
go ahead. I can't think of my calendar though. Can anyone just look at my calendar really quick? I think it's the personal calendar. No, I just need to know if it's the 26th, the Saturday. It's April.
Yes. The 26th is a Saturday.
It's the 26th.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. All right. So we actually just got we just closed of Dice and Men, which is the show that I directed with Otherworld, but we are actually going to be performing at C2E2.
Ooh, nice.
It's Saturday at 26, and it will be at 8 p.m. So if you're at C2E2 and you're there on a Saturday and you want to see Of Dice and Men, you will have another opportunity.
I think the two shows I've so far pimped out on my podcast are both performing at C2E2. So go to C2E2 if you're in Chicago. Jared?
Cool. Sorry, I really didn't mean to steal your thunder.
No, go ahead.
It's my first time here.
Everybody's nervous.
Yeah. But if you love the sound of my voice and can't get enough of it, you can hear more of it on my podcast, Alcohollywood, which you can find at alcohollywood.com. We take a movie, we create a cocktail inspired by the movie, we drink it, we teach you how to make it so you can drink it, we make up drinking rules so you can play them while watching the movie, and we then talk about the movie. While ever so slightly hammered.
Nice.
I think my geekdom, my love for movies, and my alcoholic tendencies mean I really need to be on your podcast sometime soon.
You're welcome to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or just listen to it.
I'm hoping to be on your podcast soon.
Yeah, so. You are going to be on my podcast.
Hell yeah.
You can just hold on to that hope.
All right. Really like
you can also hear my voice on the online audio drama Our Fair City.
Oh.
I'm an actor on that.
Oh, that's where you know Mark.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I know from that too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
If you have any comments, questions, or protests, or topic suggestions, you can email them to nerdoutcastpodcast@gmail.com. Like us on iTunes, it bumps us up in people's search feeds, and that's always wonderful. We said some really horrible things tonight about Empire Strikes Back or whatever, so like really just get attention. Come on, just give us attention.
Troll us.
Please, troll us. We have a bunch of exciting new topics coming in the future months here, so I'm really excited. I got a lot of good feedback from all my experts about topics, so it's going to be fun. Everybody, thank you so much for coming out tonight and discussing Ray Bradbury with me. You are all super Ray Bradbury nerds. I cannot believe it. I feel we could probably talk for another hour or two, but I need to eat dinner.
Oh,
so
yeah. Mortal.
You mortal.
Before we go, did we get a winner? Who won?
Well... I believe you gained a point and then you lost a point.
Right, so I'm
you
a zero.
Two did not gain points and you lost your negative one. So you three won.
Yeah!
Or you.
I stood out.
You won the first loser spot. So, well done, Pete. Well Thanks. Done. Again, thank you so much for coming out. I have been your host, Chris Bashan, and my guests today have been
Pete Navis,
Kitten McCreary,
Tiffany Keane,
and Jared Latour.
Thank you, and have a good evening.